Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and once again, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy life, your busy schedule, to join me for the broadcast. Today, in Florissant, it is Monday, April 9th, and I wish I could have the windows open. I wish that I could let the sun shine through, but that is just not the case. It is still winter. Unbelievable. Last night, coming home from work, we had snow flurries. And it's like 39 degrees right now. And okay, the snow won't stick. It's going to melt. But it's the point that I want to know where spring has gone. Does anybody know where spring has gone? Since about, 12, 13 days ago? How many days it's been? 19? And we have yet to have a really warm spring day. Okay? Well, there is some good news in all of my lament this morning. This Wednesday, it's going to be in the mid-60s for about 3 days. Then we go back down to 50, and then we kind of even out. So it's coming. It's just old man winter does not want to let go of many of us today. Well, really, I shouldn't complain about the weather. I know I talk about it a lot. Because on today's program, I'm going to be talking about some Iranian women who are in dire straits, who are going through things that is unimaginable under the iron grip of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so what I want to do this morning, I want to talk to you about one such Iranian woman. Her name is Golrakh Ebrahani Ari. Golrakh is a jailed human rights and women's rights activist, and she has now been on a hunger strike for more than 60 days. Her husband is Arash, and just last year, around this time, he had ended his hunger strike, and I think his hunger strike had gone beyond 60 days, 70. But they're doing it for a reason, and it's very, very unhealthy. Because of this hunger strike, Golrakh, her life is in grave danger. She is a jailed activist in Iran. She is serving a 6-year prison sentence. And what is her crime? Defending human rights and practicing her freedom of expression. Now, back on April 3rd, she was transferred to an unknown location where she was in critical condition. Let me explain exactly a little bit about this case with Golrakh and Arash, her husband. On January 23rd in 2018, Golrakh Ayari and Atna Dayami, jailed children rights activist who is serving a 7-year prison sentence, were forcibly, without any prior notice, transferred to the infamous Garachak women's prison, and that's located in Vehraman, south of Tehran. This is the prison that Rehane Jabari spent her last days in. Garachak is a prison for women who are jailed on murder and drug-related charges, and prisoners are kept in the most horrendous conditions. It is a common practice by the authorities in Iran to psychologically torture political prisoners by transferring them to such prisons in war. So this, once again, is part of their tactics. They do this as a form of psychological torture. And, of course, they learn from the best. They were trained by the Russians, and they know exactly how to do this. Now, Golrakh had begun a hunger strike way back on February 4th of this year, and the reason she did it was to protest their transfer to Garachak prison. Golrakh and Atni's demand is to be transferred back to Evin prison, where the female political prisoners are held. Now, the families of Golrakh and Atna, they contacted the authorities several times, but of course their request for an explanation why the transfer has been completely ignored and refused. And the families are not allowed to even visit Golrakh and Atni. According to them, the families, Golrakh's health has been deteriorating, and on the 3rd of April, she was transferred to an unknown location / hospital. Golrakh's family is extremely, of course, worried for her life. Several human rights organizations have sent a letter to the authorities in Iran expressing their concern and demanding the release of Golrakh and Atni. Really, on my page, I have a lengthy explanation, which I'm reading from to you right now, about Golrakh. And there are ways that you can get involved in her case. Okay? And you can just go to my Facebook page and read what I'm reading to you. How did this all begin with Golrakh? Well, first of all, she's a human rights and a women's rights activist, and she wrote a story about a woman in a film, and the name of the film, it's a famous film, The Stoning of Saraya M. And through this story, Golrakh expressed how she felt about violence against women. And now she is outraged about the punishment of stoning, and this still happens in Iran. The security forces came to her location. They found the story that Golrakh wrote. When they raided her house way back in September of 2014, they arrested Golrakh and her husband, Arash, who also was an activist. Now, the interesting thing is this story had not even been published, but in writing this story, along with her Facebook posts, where she supports political prisoners, that was enough evidence for the authorities to subject her to physical and psychological torture and to sentence her to 6 years in prison. Now, this happened, this arrest of Golrakh and her husband, Arash, they had just been married a year, and they were forcibly taken to Evin prison. Now, at that time, September 2014, they were released on bail after 7 months and were told, you're going to wait for sentencing. Now, Golrakh was not able to attend her final court hearing because she was hospitalized. She had a major surgery on a tumor, and the court never even considered her medical records, never gave her a chance to defend herself. Her charges, here's what they are: insulting Islamic sanctities and spreading propaganda against the system. And she was sentenced to 6 years in prison on these unsubstantiated charges. Now, while Golrakh was waiting to be called to prison, she wrote several letters to the Revolutionary Court to request the appeal of her sentence. Now, she also tried to appeal to many human rights organizations for support. Now, of course, her letters fell on deaf eyes and ears. She didn't get a response. Instead, she was threatened several times by the authorities to not speak to the media regarding her or her husband's case. This is a common tactic in Iran. Things that happen that are absolutely inhumane, and they will be threatened not to talk to authorities. Now, recalling her case, on October 24th, 2016, the security forces broke into the front door of Golrokh's house. They didn't even have a summons. They don't have to. And they took her to Evin prison. And when they arrested Golrokh, she asked the security guards to just please let me take my medication. At this point, she was advised to forget about her medication, and she would be in prison until she died. Golrokh is a very courageous lady. She has never given up for fighting for her freedom, and she needs our support. She is standing up for women's rights in Iran. She is supporting humanity and freedom. Here's what you can do. Go to my Facebook page. There are email addresses for President Rouhani. There's actually a letter address. You can send a postal letter to the manager of the security forces there. I want you to get involved. You may say, does this really do any good? And yes, it does. With enough pressure and enough voices from you and me and many human rights organizations, we can stop the process. We can, by the grace of God. I've seen it happen twice. Rouhani Jabari's execution was postponed, and it was due to international political pressure put on by human rights activists. So yes, it does make a difference. And even though it doesn't happen as often as we would like it to happen, it does happen. So please get involved. Go to my Facebook page. You will see what I've read to you printed right on my page. It's posted there. And there are email addresses and places where you can send your voice. Please be a voice for Golrokh. Her life is in jeopardy. This hunger strike is deteriorating her body. And she needs our voices and especially our prayers. Speaking about the women in Iran, for the last 2 years, Nazanin Ratcliffe has been a prisoner of Iran. All she did was travel there in April of 2016 with her child, Gabrielle, to see her parents. You see, Nazanin is a dual citizen of the UK and Iran. And I want to talk about her case. But what has happened in the last 2 years? Her husband, of course, doing his best to get the case through Parliament, to get some action in releasing his wife. But what has happened is that the community surrounding Richard Ratcliffe has gotten involved in an amazing way to bring awareness of her case before the media constantly. This was the case with Saeed Abedini. We never gave up. We always had his story out there in front of the media. And this is what, this is what's happening with Nazanin. The community of friends have done an amazing thing. They have put together a play. It's called Looking for Mummy, Nazanin's Story. And I felt this article was just absolutely packed with insight. It's a great article. I want to read it to you. Quote, her solitary confinement cell was about the length and width of a double bed. Although, of course, there was no bed. She had three blankets. One to cover herself with, one to use as a pillow, and one to be a mattress between her and the floor. This weekend saw Amy Howells, Looking for Mummy, Nazanin's Story, visit the Chapter Arts Center in Cardiff. The play details the story of Nazanin Zachary Ratcliffe, a British mother trapped in Iran after enduring almost 2 years of horror. I want you to hear this brief clip about the play.
What is your name?
Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe.
Why are you here? To visit my family.
Who do you work for?
A Thomson Reuters Foundation.
What is your name?
Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe.
Why are you here? To visit my family.
Who do you work for?
What have you done with my daughter?
How could I even imagine destiny would strike us separate so long?
There'd been a security agent waiting at the check-in counter desks who asked Nazanin to follow him to a room. He confiscated her travel documents, wanted to know where she worked.
Had I known, I would never have hurried to pack our suitcases for that 2-week trip to Tehran.
The security agent then escorted Nazanin and Gabriella to the departure lounge where her parents waited. He ordered Nazanin to hand Gabriella to her mother and then led Nazanin away.
One day, I will tell you the story of all these lonely days. A story of pain and separation.
It is a powerful play, and I want to give you some background information about Nazanin and then talk to you a little bit about the behind-the-scenes production of this play called Looking for Mummy. In April of 2016, Nazanin was arrested without charge at Tehran Airport, taking time out from working in the charitable sector for Thomas Reuters Foundation. She was simply on her way to board a flight back to the UK with her one-year-old daughter, Gabriella. Nazanin had been in Iran on holiday to introduce Gabriella to her country of birth and to her parents. And she remains imprisoned in Iran in highly controversial circumstances amongst allegations of torture. Looking for Mummy is a story of cyclical hope and frustration seen through the eyes of Nazanin, portrayed by Lily Nisan, and her strongest supporter, husband Richard, played by Nizan Fernandez Bridgewood. Since her incarceration, Nazanin and the campaign to free her have seen multiple glimpses of freedom snatched away by Iranian authorities. Most recently, there seemed to be substantial momentum building toward her release after Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson traveled to Iran in late 2017 to try and resolve the issue after his well-documented blunder at Parliament in November. Since then, however, progress has once again stalled. Most obvious throughout the production is the love of both parents for their daughter, Gabriella, who has now spent most of her life living with Nazanin's parents in Iran. The most painful part of this whole affair is that neither of us have been able to witness our daughter growing up, admits Richard's character in the production. Now, reading on. Richard Radcliffe has courageously led the campaign for Nazanin's freedom and has followed the production from its inception. Speaking in an interview, he admitted that when Emmy first approached him as a student, quote, he had no right to expect how good it would become. There were things in that story that when I saw how a year played back, I hadn't seen living it. There is a way in which you see the characters. They both started confused and then got angry, and then there is a resonance that comes. That was always there, but I didn't experience. My experience of speaking to Nazanin most of the time is her being sad on the phone and me trying to cheer her up and not having the words to do it. So to rediscover the strength that was always there was something only the play could have given me. Producer and actor Emmy Howell tells me of the importance of offering the audience an opportunity to see the full picture of Nazanin's story rather than just reading a news bulletin. We've managed to create here does show the audience not only her story, but all the other elements that on their own are just little things. But when you put them together, it's astounding that something like this is happening. Multiple roles actor Davey Siegel says the reason why Nazanin's story is able to hit home so effectively is it's normal people who are trapped in this ridiculous, ludicrous, absurd situation over which they have no control. It's three people who you could know trapped in this ridiculous game of world politics. It's a very different reading. It's a very different thing reading about it in a newspaper compared to hearing Nazanin's own overwhelming words and hearing that truth. The play also makes an overt point of not shying away from the politics that's surrounding the story, with criticism of the British government, including references to past arms deals between Iran and the West that may have pointed to as a potential motive for the incarceration of Nazanin and other dual nationals in Iran. Indeed, Mr. Ratcliffe's character exclaims at one point, quote, I accuse my government of not having my family's best interests at heart. Now, speaking at Trust Conference 2017 in November, Thomson Reuters Foundation's CEO, Monique Villa, called the treatment of Nazanin a mockery of justice. Now, we can get involved in this in a very practical way. There are petitions you can sign for Nazanin's freedom. There is pressure we can put on the British government to get this ball rolling in the right direction and not give up until she's released. You can visit freenazanin.com, F-R-E-E, Nazanin, N-A-Z-A-N-I-N.com. And for more on the story, for petitions you can sign. Now, this is an important thing for you and me to do, is to not only get involved in a practical way with signing petitions and pressuring the government, but also praying for Nazanin's release. I've been doing that for the past 2 years, and I can't even begin to fathom and understand what it's like for a husband not to be with his wife, not to be able to watch their own daughter grow up. It is horrible beyond words. But what we do here as human rights activists is to never give up. I spent the weekend watching The Darkest Hour, Gary Oldman, who played Winston Churchill. It was an amazing film. What a great job he did. And one of the most famous lines in his speech before Parliament, right before Britain was engaged in a war with Germany and the bombings began, Winston Churchill, in his most famous remark, talked about fighting the enemy on the beaches and defending the island, not giving into peace negotiations, and then the famous line, we shall never surrender. Well, in the same way, we as human rights activists will never surrender until Nazanin is reunited with her husband and they can bring their daughter together and raise her in a normal way at their home in the UK. So let's get involved. Let's pressure the government. Let's speak out and let's pray for Nazanin's release. Now, a little bit closer to home. And this is another story of a prisoner. We have a prisoner of Gorakh, prisoner of Nazanin, and prisoner Pastor Andrew Brunson. American Pastor Andrew Brunson is now facing what could amount to the rest of his life in a Turkish prison. What is the charge that Pastor Andrew Brunson is being jailed with? Christianization. A 62-page indictment, a diatribe about Christianity, against Christianity in Israel, claims that the Christian pastor living out his Christian faith, including through humanitarian aid, education, and training, that amounts to terrorism, according to the government of Turkey. If convicted, he faces 35 years in a Turkish prison, essentially a life sentence for the 50-year-old American pastor. Now, this trial gets started in just 1 week on April 16. So time is of the essence. Christianity is on trial in Turkey. But Christianity isn't terrorism. This is an absolute outrage. Pastor Andrew has peacefully served the people of Turkey as a Christian pastor, following the law without issue for the past 23 years. And we cannot allow Turkey, our supposed NATO ally, to sentence a U.S. citizen to the rest of his life behind bars for just being a Christian and living out his faith. You can get involved with Jay Sekulow and the American Center for Law and Justice. Go to my Facebook page. The petition is there. Please sign. And let's urge President Trump to get on board and to do something in a very positive way for Pastor Andrew Brunson. I want you to hear a special plea by his daughter before the UN in Geneva just a few months ago. I want you to hear this.
I pass the floor to the European Center for Law and Justice.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm here today on behalf of the ECLJ, who is representing my father, Pastor Andrew Brunson, the innocent United States citizen who has been wrongfully imprisoned in Turkey now for almost a year and a half, and yet he has still not been formally charged with any crime. Having grown up in Turkey, it has been hard for me to understand the situation. My family loves and respects the Turkish people, and my father has been dedicated to serving them for over two decades. I know the allegations against him are absurd. He is not an armed terrorist trying to overthrow any government. My father is a peaceful pastor. My family has suffered greatly during the past year and a half, which has been filled with tears and countless unanswered questions. I visited my father last August, and we sobbed the entire visit. It was hard to see him so broken, so thin, so desperate. He wrote a note last week which said, "Let it be clear. I am in prison not for anything I have done wrong, but because of who I am, a Christian pastor. I desperately miss my wife and children. Yet, I believe this to be true. It is an honor to suffer for Jesus Christ, as many have before me. My deepest thanks to all those around the world who are standing with and praying for me." Turkey should not get away with holding my father one more day. Please make any and all efforts to secure my father's release and safe return to the United States. He's been falsely imprisoned for far too long. Thank you.
That is Pastor Brunson's daughter speaking at the United Nations in Geneva. I think it was many years ago, I don't know the exact number of years, that I wrote a song for the persecuted church. And I'm not a music producer. I just have simple keys and abilities. And I put this song together when Saeed Abedini was in prison and dedicated it to him. But today I'm thinking of Pastor Andrew Brunson, a Christian pastor wrongly imprisoned in Turkey for his Christian faith. And I'm thinking of also the many political prisoners in Iran, the many Christians who are suffering for their faith all over the world. What you're about to hear is my original song. It's very basic quality, but the thought, the words, and the music are of high quality in the sense that it's dedicated to their cause. And so this is the debut of my song called Faces, dedicated to the persecuted church. I hope I can get it to play. There it goes.
I'd like to dedicate this song, Faces, to my dear friend Negma and Saeed, and all persecuted Christians throughout the world who are suffering for their Christian faith. And every time we see their face, let's offer up to God our sincere prayer. see the pain reflecting in their eyes. They don't complain, they're not afraid to die. They've won their battle, they've overcome all the lies. I see their faces in all of the tears that they cry.
I'm learning how to live, I'm learning how to love, and I'm learning how to forgive. Yours truly, with a simple way of just kind of putting a song together, but to share with you the message of hope for the persecuted church, for Pastor Brunson, for many of the political prisoners, that when you see their faces, you wonder how they have the courage to not deny Christ. What is it about Jesus? What is it about Jesus that keeps prisoners under such stress to have such grace to say, no, I will not deny him? What is it about Jesus? I have a friend. Her name is Fatima. And I met her on Telegram. I think she's a friend of one of my other Iranian friends. And she has approached me because she wanted to know why I believe as a Christian what I believe. Can you share your faith with me? Well, of course. Well, Fatima is not a Muslim in name only. Unlike a lot of my Iranian friends, she is a practicing Muslim. She's pretty serious about it. However, she has told me in our conversations that she has joined an online Christian group. She's investigating Christianity. And so I have sent her my book on PDF files, my Cross in the Desert book, and I've shared with her why Iranian women are opposed to Islam. And Fatima, although she's interested in knowing about Christ, she's told me that, and she's interested in understanding, she is still a defender of Islam. And when I challenged Fatima about the reasons why so many Iranians are turning away from Islam, that they're looking for their hope and freedom in Jesus. And I've reasoned with her. I said, look at the fruit of Islam in Iran. And her comeback is simply this. Well, this is the government that makes Islam look bad. Islam is really yet a good religion. So I have challenged her. I've shared with her, look, we're talking about religion, but I'm talking about a love relationship. I've shared my blogs with her. And I said to her, I said, look at the differences between Muhammad and Jesus, their character, their teaching. Jesus never sinned, yet Muhammad did. The Quran tells us that. And she goes back and forth, somehow defending Islam. What's going on here? With all of the information, the biblical truth I've shared with her, what's going on? Well, it's very simple. It's called spiritual blindness. And today I want to talk to you about the subject of spiritual blindness. And the way I want to deal with this subject is go to the Bible. John chapter 9 is going to be our text. And we're going to read about someone that had physical blindness. But I want to make a point about all of this. So if you have your Bibles nearby, I want you to open them up to John chapter 9. John chapter 9. I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. Rabbi, his disciples asked him, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or his parents' sins? Jesus corrected this misunderstanding. Quote, it was not because of his sins or his parents' sins, Jesus answered. This happened so the power of God could be seen in him. We must quickly carry out the tasks assigned us by the one who sent us. The night is coming, and then no one can work. But while I am here in the world, I am the light of the world. Then Jesus spit on the ground, made mud with saliva, and spread the mud over the blind man's eyes. He told him, go wash yourself in the pool of Siloam. Siloam means sent. So the man went and washed, and lo and behold, he came back seeing. His neighbors and others who knew him as a blind beggar asked each other, isn't this the man who used to sit and beg? Some said he was, and others said, no, he just looks like him. But the beggar kept saying, yes, I am the same one. They asked, who healed you? What happened? He told them, the man they called Jesus made mud and spread it over my eyes and told me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash yourself. So I went and washed, and now I can see. Where is he now? They asked. I don't know, he replied. Then they took the man who had been blind to the Pharisees because it was on the Sabbath that Jesus had made the mud and healed him. The Pharisees asked the man all about it. So he told them, he put the mud over my eyes, and when I washed it away, I could see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man Jesus is not from God, for he is working on the Sabbath. Others said, but how could an ordinary sinner do such miraculous signs? So, division of opinion among them. Then the Pharisees again questioned the man who had been born blind and demanded, what's your opinion about this man who healed you? The man replied, I think he must be a prophet. The Jewish leaders still refused to believe the man had been blind and now could see. So they called in his parents. They asked them, is this your son? Was he really born blind? If so, how can he now see? His parents replied, we know this is our son, and that he was born blind, but we don't know how he can see or who healed him. Ask him. He's old enough to speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who would announce that anyone saying Jesus was the Messiah would be expelled from the synagogue. That's why they said, he is old enough. Ask him. So, for the second time, they called in the man who had been blind and told him, God should get glory for this because we know this man, Jesus, he's a sinner. I don't know whether he is a sinner, the man replied, but I know this. I was blind and now I can see. But what did he do? How did he heal you? Look, the man explained. I told you once. Didn't you listen? Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they cursed him and said, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know God spoke to Moses, but we don't even know where this man comes from. Why, that's very strange, the man replied. He healed my eyes, and yet you don't know where he comes from? We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but he is ready to hear those who worship him and do his will. Ever since the world began, no one has been able to open the eyes of someone born blind. If this man were not from God, he couldn't have done it. You were born a total sinner, they answered. Are you trying to teach us? And they threw him out of the synagogue. But when Jesus heard what happened, he found the man and asked, do you believe in the Son of Man? The man answered, who is he, sir? I want to believe in him. You have seen him, Jesus said, and he is speaking to you. Yes, Lord, I believe, the man said, and he worshiped Jesus. Then Jesus told him, I entered this world to render judgment, to give sight to the blind, and show those who think they see that they are blind. Some Pharisees who were standing nearby heard him and asked, are you saying we're blind? If you were blind, you wouldn't be guilty, Jesus replied, but you remain guilty because you claim you can see. So ends the reading of the astonishing, amazing miracle of the man born blind who was healed, and the stubborn, hardened hearts of the Pharisees, who, though they could physically see, were spiritually blind. This is the case with my friend Fatima, being confronted with the truth. And yet she defends the very religion that she seems to be wanting to understand more about Christianity and leave. But what is the problem here? The Bible says, the God of this world has blinded the minds of them that believe not, lest they believe. It is the God of this world, Satan, who brings blindness to the unbelievers. He has blinded their eyes, the Bible says. I want to delve a little bit deeper in this, though. I want you to hear what I'm saying. And in order to do that, to make my point, I want to read to you from my book about Mariah and her friend Andrea. Andrea is Mariah's friend, and they're flying together in Mariah's plane. Mariah takes her blind friend Andrea up in the plane, and what she does is she describes all of the scenery to her blind friend Andrea. And Andrea has this wonderful experience as she's riding in the plane to hear what Mariah says. And it just fills her heart with such joy. And I want you to hear in this brief section that once again Andrea is hearing Mariah describe the scenery as she flies her Cessna. Andrea, it's gorgeous. The beautiful green forests and treetops stretching out along the mountains. Look, there's a lake, the crystal blue water, a tiny sailboat, and now we're climbing up to the mountain peak. It looks so majestic. I can see it, Mariah. You paint so well with words. A tiny tear trickled down Andrea's face as she was overcome by the beauty of the word pictures that Mariah was painting. As the Cessna gained altitude once again, departing from the mountain range, Mariah banked the Cessna to the left, heading southwest toward the gorgeous sunset. The sun was dipping below the horizon like a giant orange fiery ball, radiating red and purple streaks across the sky, signaling the approach of nightfall. It's so beautiful, Mariah exclaimed. The sunset is so gorgeous tonight, Andrea. The sun is fading beneath the horizon, a giant orange fireball. There are red and purple colors radiating across the sky. I wish you could really see this. Andrea's face became aglow. I can, Mariah. I can. It's the beauty of God surrounding us. He is calling to us right now. Mariah's whole demeanor seemed to change. She cleared her throat and became silent. Mariah, please come back to God. God is calling you. Just run to him. Mariah remained quiet for a few more moments. Andrea was touching on a very sensitive subject, and Mariah could feel the raging turmoil in her soul. I don't see what you see anymore, Andrea. I don't see the beauty that you see. There's too much ugliness in the world, too much evil in the world. Andrea reached over and gently touched Mariah's arm. She could feel the tightness and resistance in her arm from her touch. God understands your feelings, and he promises that one day there will be no more crying, sorrow, pain, or death. He promises to wipe the tears from our eyes and make everything new. Suddenly, the atmosphere inside the Cessna became thick with tension. What was once a thrilling joyride had now become a locked room that Mariah was desperate to escape from. Andrea, we live in the here and now. One day to me is just wishful thinking, what we are supposed to do until one day. Do you want me to tell that to my friend Amna? Will that really give her any hope? Just hold on, Amna. It may get better one day. Andrea bowed her head in sadness and remained silent. Mariah had become so cynical and hard-hearted. She realized that she had very little chance of penetrating the wall between them. The Cessna 172 left the glorious colors of the sunset and turned toward home. From my book, Dance with the Fireflies, The Flight Around the World, this story illustrates a very important point along with the teaching we just read from John chapter 9. Jesus, the miracle-working Messiah, demonstrated that he truly was God by healing this man born blind. And this man was interrogated by the hard-hearted religious leaders of his day. They would not accept the fact that whoever this man was, according to them, he was healing on the Sabbath, so he couldn't be sent from God. Why would he break the Sabbath? This is our holy day. How dare him heal you? They couldn't deny that he was healed, but they didn't agree with why he was healed. He was healing on their Sabbath day. And this man, why? He's a sinner. He can't be sent from God. And the blind man continued to make his case. I was blind and now I see. And Jesus said, do you believe in me? And the man bowed down and worshiped him, praising Yahweh for this amazing miracle of taking away his blindness and giving him sight for the first time. He can see the world around him. And what a joyous day that was. And yet, Jesus turned to the hard-hearted religious leaders who could clearly see but were unable to believe in him as the Messiah. They had physical eyesight, but Jesus says, your sin remains because you claim you can see, but you cannot see and come to the conclusion about who I am. The miracle is done before your eyes. But you are guilty of sin and judgment and spiritual blindness. This is the case with Mariah and Andrea. Mariah doesn't believe the Christian faith anymore. She believes that there are many ways to God. She's no longer following Christ. And Andrea, who is blind, has more eyesight as a blind person than Mariah, who has no excuse, who can clearly see but has hardened her heart against the truth. Oh, the sin of spiritual blindness. While the Bible says that the God of this world has blinded the mind of unbelievers, there is a part that unbelievers play as well. The Bible makes it very clear that we have turned away from the truth willfully. We have embraced a lie willfully because we refuse to see Jesus and believe Jesus for who he is. We have exchanged the truth for a lie. Unbelievers who are confronted with the atheist, with the evidence right before their eyes, shut their hearts and minds away from the truth. As I was sharing with Fatima and sharing the truth claims of Christ with her, she continued to turn away and continue to embrace Islam as a good religion. And it gets frustrating, but I realized, just like the religious leaders of Jesus' day, who could see clearly with their physical eyes, but their hearts were in opposition to Jesus. Spiritual blindness is a prison. For those who claim they can see clearly, who understand reality, who understand that, you know, Christianity is just another religion, and you really can't believe all of those miracles, that's thousands of years ago, they can clearly see the evidence before their eyes, but they're unwilling to embrace the truth. And so Jesus says, if you were blind, you would not be guilty. But the fact that you're not blind and you can clearly see, God's judgment is upon you. It is amazing, isn't it? If you were blind, you wouldn't be guilty, Jesus said, but you remain guilty because you claim you can see. The unbeliever claims he can clearly see reality, that he understands logic and reason, and that your faith in this Christ is so illogical. Don't you know that the Bible is thousands of years old? Who can believe that today? Don't you know there are many religions? Islam is the fastest growing religion. How can you claim that you know this Jesus? Jesus would say, your sin remains with you because you claim you can see, but you are spiritually blinded to the truth. Jesus says to Pilate, for this reason I came into the world, to bear witness of the truth. And as Jesus stood before Pilate, after being scourged and nearly dead, Pilate, listening to the word truth, could say, what is truth? Mocking it with a cynical attitude. When the light of truth shines in the darkness, there is a reaction. There is a rebuttal. There is a resistance. There is a pulling away. The light is exposing the sin. And because you're living in sin, you run away, you hide. Because the light is revealing. The light is unearthing the truth of who you are. The man born blind had a need. He had a physical need. When Jesus healed his physical need, he opened his heart up to worship. His response, I was blind, and now I see. There is a deeper problem, though. For those who claim they can see, who weren't born blind like the beggar, who claim they are reasonable, thinking people living in a scientific age, like Stephen Hawking, who said, that's a fairy tale. Here was a man with such great intellect who understood a lot about the universe, but he refused in his spiritual blindness to embrace the one who created it. Oh, the sin, the deception of spiritual blindness. What is your response today to the reading of God's word, to the man born blind who can now see? Are you going to be like the man born blind? Your eyes are opened and you say, Jesus, you are the way, the truth, and the life. Or are you going to be like the religious leaders who shut their eyes, close their hearts to the truth, and walk away so satisfied that what they believe is true? Are you going to be like the man born blind or like the religious leaders? The cure for spiritual blindness is turning your heart and your life over to Jesus. It's embracing him. It's coming to him. It's realizing that what you need is not religion. You don't need religion. You need a relationship with the very God of the universe who has come to set you free from your guilt and your sin. Jesus, the light of the world, came into a darkened world and shined his light of truth and love and teachings for 3.5 years and then offered up himself to God the Father as a living sacrifice to atone for our sins. Oh, this is not religion. This is having a relationship with your Creator. It is opening your eyes and seeing your need. It's recognizing that you are like a spiritual beggar, broken in sin, and need more than a Band-Aid. You need a cure. You need the cure for cancer, and that is Jesus. Jesus has come to give you life. Today, if you're that person living in a world of spiritual blindness, come to Jesus. He will take away all of your guilt and your feelings and your guilt and the weight of sin. He will cleanse you. He will make you brand new. He will give you eyes to see the truth. He will give you eyes to gaze upon his beauty. He will give you eyes to look at this world around you and recognize that your only hope is Christ, because he has come to give you life and life more abundantly. Isaac Newton wrote a song about his spiritual blindness being cured. And I want to leave you with that song today, performed by Chris Tomlin, Amazing Grace. I will see you next time on The Cross in the Desert. As long as life.